Introducing the new low-fat Subway Buffalo Chicken. Spicy chicken, cool light ranch, one hot sandwich. All the flavor you love with 7 grams of fat. For a limited time, hurry to Subway and enjoy the newest part of a Subway Fresh Fit meal. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Yeah. All right, welcome to BS Report. Friday afternoon, the Yankees have won the World Series. We're going to talk to Jacko in a little bit. But first, the World Series of Poker, the final table. It's happening this weekend, and then we're running it on ESPN. On what night is it, Norman Chad? Tuesday?
Tuesday night at 9 o'clock Eastern.
Welcome to the Subway Fresh Take Hotline.
It feels like the Subway Hotline.
Is it making you hungry?
Actually, I just had some roasted peanuts, so I'll have to
Beautiful.
Wait a couple of hours.
Well, it's been long overdue. You're one of my favorite writers. Way back in the day, you wrote for The National, a paper that my mother used to mail me. Because they only, sold it, like New York, Boston, they sold it all the major cities, but none of the suburbs, basically. And my mother would have to buy them and mail them to me in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Yeah, they were hard to find, even in the cities that you mentioned, they were hard to find in the city. Sometimes people would tell me that they would go to buy it, they would open up the box, and it would be like 3-day-old newspaper that was in there. So it was a tough distribution problem.
And how did you morph into ESPN's poker guy? Because once upon a time, you were the guy writing TV columns making fun of the broadcasters.
Yeah, and I still do sometimes, but it's a little harder these days. And I was doing other work for ESPN, both stuff on PTI and some consulting work. And then when they decided to do more poker for 2003, I was pretty much the only person they knew with a gambling problem. So they asked me to consult with the production company that was going to be doing poker, because the production company had never done poker before. So I just consulted with them on how to do the broadcast for several months by conference call and email. And then out of the blue, they called me up one day and said, we got an odd question for you. Ever considered doing poker commentary on television? And I remember telling them, I said, geez, Matt, it's every little boy's dream to do poker commentary on TV since they're five. What are you talking about? It didn't even exist. So they asked me to do it, and I thought about it for a few days and said, sure. And it wasn't much of a big deal because no one knew that poker on television, that people are actually going to watch it.
When you were making fun of announcers once upon a time, did you ever imagine that you would actually become an announcer?
No, I didn't. I mean, I knew it was a possibility, but I never, looked to do television or radio. And, I burned so many bridges, there's no way I could come back over to where I was before. And I still burn bridges, and I guess I found another way to get back.
Well, is your old book still in print?
I don't think so. I mean, I know people ask me about it, and I just direct them to Amazon or Barnes & Noble online or eBay or something. I don't think it's in print. When that generally was, that was almost all about sports television, and I'm sure, one-third of the chapters had to do with ESPN. So,
yeah, it's amazing you ended up on ESPN.
It is. There's an incredible paper trail to where I'm essentially, setting the ESPN campus on fire. And then several years later, I'm in the, campus cafeteria, having a nice BLT.
There's one chapter in there. You did a 24-hour, what year was that? You did the 24-hour marathon running diary. And by the way, you were the creator of the running diary.
Yeah, I got into trouble, Bill, last year when I did another one.
I know. Listen, anytime anybody emails me about that, I always email them that I had never, ever seen the timestamp thing before you. But did you create it or did somebody else do it before you?
Almost everybody does something before you when you don't think so. I know I just started doing it myself, but I didn't pick it up from anybody else, but I'm sure somebody else did it. And then when I did it last year for my column, I was unaware and would have not have done it. I was unaware that Will Leach had, in his book, had done, watching ESPN for 24 hours.
Yeah, but you had already done that, though.
Yeah, I know. So when I got a lot of bad email about it, and Will made fun of me, and I just emailed him back that by the way, you know, I did this, you know, in fact, I've been putting off that ESPN column for about 2 or 3 years because I couldn't find a free 24 hours.
Yeah.
Because I was on the road a lot. And I said, I was going to write this column for the last 2 or 3 years. Two, I didn't know you was in your book. And three, you know, it's on record. I've watched 24 hours for a column, you know, 1991 or two. I can't remember what year it was. So,
did you really watch the 24, though, or did you go to sleep?
The first 24 I did in 91 or 92 when I was, you know, stronger and of better mind, I did watch. This time I cheated. This time I actually went to sleep. I forgot what time it started, but I went to sleep like at 2 in the morning and picked it up again around 5:30 in the morning and just, you know, skipped. I think I skipped some health infomercials or something. But I tried to do it as best I could.
Well, when I used to read it on the National, and I used to love when you did the timestamp thing. And I think my old column started when I started my old website in like 1997. Like the third column I ever did was the running diary of the NBA draft. At that point, I didn't know what happened to you. You went to the National, then you ended up at Sports Illustrated, and that was unhappy, right? You left within like 6 months.
Yeah, I had a one-year contract to write a weekly column there, but 2 months in, the guy who hired me got fired. The guy who came in said, you know, we're not running this. We're not running this crap.
Right.
So, yeah, essentially, my weekly column became a once-every-six-week column at the end of the year I left.
And then after that, I didn't know what happened to you. I didn't know where you went. So I was like, well, the timestamp, I guess I'll start doing them. And then you resurfaced. All of a sudden, you had a picks column that was syndicated. What year was that? Like somewhere in the late 90s?
Yeah, actually, that column I started the last year the National was around, and I started writing in the Washington Post then in 1992 and probably started syndicating it in 95 or 6, somewhere in there.
Yeah, the Globe picked it up, I'm going to say. It was after I had already started my site, and I was so excited because this is before the Internet. Like, I didn't know what happened to you after the SI thing. And for all I knew, you were, like, bartending. And all of a sudden you were back and you're doing football picks column. But yeah, thank you because you definitely had a big impact on me. There's, you know, I think when you're a writer in your formative years, you have those 8 or 9 writers that hit you at the right time, and you were definitely one of them for me. You were the first writer that I'd ever read who made fun of announcers. You know, this is something that my friends and I had been talking about nonstop, but yet you would never see in a sports column ever. Like, did you take heat for that originally?
Yeah, it came naturally because it's something I'd been doing since I was in college. About, you know, it's same thing you're doing with your friends. You're sitting around and you're making fun of all the sports announcers, and
yeah,
it's actually more fun than watching the telecast, or they're more annoying or more aggravating.
Right.
So it just came naturally. And when I first did it at the Washington Post, they reined me in a lot. They thought I was too far out on the edge, and this is why the National was the greatest break in the world for me, because the National just, you know, was created out of nothing. So they didn't care what I did at first. There was no circulation.
We thought about for 30 for 30, we did think about doing a documentary in the National. That was like kind of made like the semifinals of what was going to be in the final cut.
I can see it not making the final cut. The semifinals was pretty good.
Well, I don't think, you know, nobody under 25 even knows that A, there was an all-sports newspaper that bombed and lost $100 million, mainly not because it wasn't good, but because of just how screwed up the business side of it was. But then, you know, I think it really was the blueprint for eventually what the mainstream sports websites became, like ESPN.com and SI.com and Yahoo.com. This was a centralized place for all sports information, for features, for columns that were geared toward a national audience, not a local audience. And, yeah, it really should have worked.
Yeah, it had bad timing. You're right, it was a good blueprint, and it just had bad timing. It had a bad business model. And actually, you're right. Actually, I disappeared, and then when I always kept writing, but then the younger 30 crowd, when they occasionally would come across my column, I run in this so many times, not so much the last couple of years as previous years, where I'd get email from people telling me that I essentially was imitating you.
Yeah.
That I'm a poor man's Bill Simmons. And
that's not true.
This never sat well with me, but
no,
it made me.
Shouldn't have.
The funny thing, Bill, is that it reminded me of I grew up in Washington, D.C., and a guy who actually, at a local sportscaster level, who was ahead of his time, was Warner Wolf, who did videotape like nobody else did. And he left. And then George Michael came in, and George Michael was king of, you know, he had his syndicated sports machine on Saturday nights or Sunday nights. And then Warner came back years later to Washington after being in New York. And when he came back, a generation of people had never seen him. And when they saw him doing it, they said, geez, he's taking George Michael's act.
Right.
And I felt so bad for Warner because Warner invented George Michael's act.
Right.
And Warner never did well again in Washington because they just said, he's a poor man's George Michael.
I don't remember Warner coming back to Washington.
Yeah, it didn't last long. He came back to the station that got started, the CBS affiliate there. The same anchors were there. It's no one ever leaves Washington television. It's a great job. So, yeah, Warner came back, I'm saying, sometime in the late 90s, mid-90s. He actually ended up replacing a very good sportscaster who passed away, Glenn Brenner, who was the funniest local sportscaster I'd ever seen, and he died of a brain tumor. And they brought Warner back to replace him, and just it didn't work out. And, you know, Warner might have lost a little off his fastball, but he was still doing the same thing he was doing in the late 60s and early 70s, but people thought he was poaching off of George Michael.
Yeah, but the apex for Warner was obviously Rocky IV.
What's that?
The apex for Warner was obviously Rocky IV.
Yeah, actually,
Creed fight.
That was great for Warner.
He also has an awesome Plays of the Decade special from the 80s.
Oh, I've never seen that.
That is on YouTube now. You can find it somewhere. But it's like the definitive blooper of the decade, which the whole blooper concept, I don't know, for some reason we enjoyed it more in the 80s than we do now. I still feel like I could enjoy a current blooper special, but
I think we enjoyed it more in the 80s than we do now.
Yeah, I don't know why.
With everything.
I feel like I would still enjoy it, though.
But sometimes, though, when I write a timestamp column, that's when I get these emails saying, you know, first of all, when you write them, you have a different space consideration. You know, when you write them, they're incredibly long, and you have more room to do what you want to do. Mine are always compacted into 600 or 800 words.
I think it's ours are pretty different, like. The way they read, I think, you know, I think you, as you said, you have the space constraints. You go for the nuts and bolts kind of, you know, setup delivery, and I'll go into these different weird parentheses, tangents, all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, yeah, you did it. It was yours. And
I'm going to forward all these emails to you if you can talk to these people personally and let them know I wasn't stealing from you.
You know, but like it's like, you know, I started doing the mailbag in 97, and that was basically, the idea for that was David Letterman's Viewer Mail.
Right.
Which I had never really seen in print, and I was like, it would be cool if I had a place for my readers to kind of vent and run the weirdest emails I get, and I write responses. The problem is I barely had any readers. So I had these mailbags that had like 6 emails, and that was like a great mailbag. I had 6. But you end up taking... You know, I think like another thing that really impacted me was the book Wait Till Next Year by William Goldman.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wrote from the fan's perspective, and
yep.
He was so tortured, and it was like, I just felt like, yeah, that would work in a sports column, first person, and then you just take different pieces from different people. But you were definitely one of those people for me. Tell me about the poker table, final table, Phil Ivey lurking, but somebody's got like 5 times as many chips as somebody else.
Yeah, actually, this incredible Forrest Gump-like character, Darvin Moon, a logger, runs his own lumbering business, logging business in Western Maryland, a 3-man lumbering business. He has 30% of the chips at the final table. The final table's 9 players, and Phil Ivey is one of the short stacks. But just the presence of those two alone, Bill, you know, the main event is just terrific because anyone can play, anyone can win. You get all walks of life into there, and the fact that this year we have... You know, the sort of unanimous best player on the planet in Phil Ivey, and then this incredible, improbable, unimaginable figure of Darvin Moon is just as good as it gets. Those two are just great storylines.
Like, if you're doing a fantasy draft, those would be the two you picked.
They would. You could not script. I mean, again, it's just like the name, you know, Chris Moneymaker was a great story, and it was made greater by the fact that his name was Chris Moneymaker. You could not script a better character than Darvin Moon, including his name. I never call him Moon. He's always Darvin or Darvin Moon. And he's just a remarkable figure to watch and to talk to. And it's like he's walked out of the woods. He's almost walked all the way to Las Vegas. He'd never been on a commercial jetliner before coming to the World Series. And now he's going to try to walk on home with $8.5 million. It's pretty cool.
Do you, Phil Ivey, how old is he now?
Phil Ivey's 32 years old.
I mean, we've had poker stars before, and, you know, we know who they are, and they're not really stars, and I don't think there's really anything compelling about them. Like, I actually think Phil Hellmuth is kind of boorish, and, you know, Moneymaker. A lot of these guys are flash-in-the-pan guys. Johnny Chan has the, the rounders thing, but ultimately none of these guys are that compelling. They are what they are. Ivy is the one guy to me that's compelling. Like, he's, to me, potentially the Tiger Woods of poker. He might be able to get there. If he came back and he, you know, from the big deficit and he won this tournament, does he become the Tiger Woods of poker?
He's it's hard to say in poker, Bill. It's different than tennis or golf or bowling. It's really hard to quantify the best players in poker. There's so many different measuring standards. There's tournaments, there's cash play, there's online. Phil though is probably the best. Phil Ivey's probably the best player in terms of all the different skills. He plays all the different games. He plays tournaments, he plays cash, he plays high limit, he plays online. He plays more than just hold'em. If he does win this, he's on the very, very short list of you know, the best players of all time that you can think of that are public figures. He doesn't like to be called the Tiger Woods of poker, frankly. He hates that term. But
Michael Jordan of poker?
The Michael Jordan of poker he would prefer.
The Shannon Tweed of poker?
For some reason. The Walter Wade Williams Jr. of poker. He's a compelling figure, you're right. And actually, sometimes he's almost like Sinatra. There's a mysterious quality to him. There's a mystique to him that most people in the poker world don't even know him that well. And when he walks into the room, you don't notice anybody else. When he sits down at the table, your eyes are fixated on him. And he barely says a word at the table sometimes for an hour or two on end. But there's just something fascinating about him and his gambling quality. Yeah, he plays at the highest levels in everything he plays. You know, he walks into a dice table and he'll win or lose, you know, several hundred thousand dollars in 15 minutes and then just walk out. Everything he does is for the highest amount of money, and he probably has a gambling problem.
Well, I would say there are two factors at work that give him the added mystique. One is that he doesn't wear sunglasses for the most part, right?
Correct. He tried it. Actually, he said he wore them once, misread his hand, and then he threw them into the trash can. But thankfully, he does not wear sunglasses ever now.
Like, to not wear sunglasses at a table, in my opinion, is like a quarterback just deciding he's going to wear, you know, Pop Warner pads over the real pads so he can throw the ball farther. It just seems like a disadvantage. But for him, it's an advantage because it makes him more intimidating.
It does. It's an amazing thing that without saying a word, you think twice about entering a pot with him. He has an intimidating presence at the table. By the way, he's a friendly, amiable, personable guy with an incredible sense of humor. But when you're sitting across from him at the table, he is an intimidating presence.
That's the one thing. And then the other thing, this sounds like a cliche, but he's got the greatest poker face ever. It doesn't move. It's like a mask. It's like a Phil Ivey mask. Never changes. He's got the eyes. They're always the same size. They're just kind of studying everything. And he's the most unflappable guy I've ever seen at any of those tables.
You're right. We actually did a joke with him a few years ago where we showed him after he wins a big pot. We showed him after he loses a big pot. We showed him when he's about to, you know, get an apple. The face is always the same. It is unflappable. And, yeah, it's very hard to read. The closest thing to him that way is Chris Ferguson, Jesus, who doesn't seem to move a muscle, doesn't seem to take a breath when he's at the table. But Phil, and Chris is a very good player. Phil's a much better player. Again, Chris Ferguson only plays tournaments. He's best at hold'em. Phil's better at all the other games. But both of them at the poker table, it's hard to get a read on either one of them.
It's also like poker, let's be honest, poker's not a cool sport. It's not a sport that cool people gravitate towards. It's a sport of people that are, you know, for the most part, fundamentally a little weird, I think. You know, they're loners or they're people that maybe, you know, didn't go to prep schools and Ivy League colleges, things like that. Ivy seems like somebody to me that would have succeeded in whatever he chose to do. Does that make sense?
Well, he's very he's one of those guys like a Michael Jordan who seems to be ultra competitive.
Yeah.
And will do whatever it takes to win that game, whatever he's playing. So he might not be as skilled at some of the games he plays, but you know, he's going to get pretty good at anything he does. And for the younger guys, he's one of the more interesting. One of the problems we've had, Bill, is that with the internet explosion, you have all these, you know, 21 to 25 year olds who essentially have just been sitting in front of a computer for several years playing poker. They're not interesting. They're not compelling. Phil still is compelling, and the older poker players were compelling because, again, they came from all walks of life. Some of them were lawyers. You know, some of them were from Wall Street. Some of them were doctors, and they just did a lot of weird things. And today's poker players are all just pretty much internet guys who have been in front of a computer since they were 15 or 16 years old.
And, like somebody like Bill Brunson. He felt like a significant character. Like he was like out of a movie. And now I don't feel that way when I see most of these poker guys. They seem to me like, you know, as you said, people who learn their bones online or something. Phil Ivey, you know, if you read anything about him, it's this guy who was sneaking off, where was it, to Atlantic City?
Yeah, when
he was like 18.
He was 17, 18, and he got a fake ID. His name was Jerome Graham, and they all called him No Home Jerome because he would sit there and play for 14, 16 hours at a time. And
right.
He had a fake ID. He went into Atlantic City casinos when he was about 18 years old. You have to be at least 21, and he played underage. And then when he turned 21, he came in and he introduced himself to everybody. Hi, my name is actually Phil.
Right.
I'm now 21 years old. So that alone is fascinating that he would come in there for 3 or 4 years. He's from a great family. You know, I think his mother's a teacher. It's a white collar family, and he's sneaking off to play at casinos at the age of 17 or 18. It's just fascinating to me.
How much money do we think he has?
That's more than a $64,000 question. It's a lot of money because before his – forget the fact that if he only played poker, he'd have even more money because he often loses at everything else. You know, he loves betting sports. He's a big Lakers fan. He loves playing dice. He loses – most poker players lose at everything else. But even if he didn't play poker, he's one of the founding fathers of Full Tilt, the online site. So he gets a small percentage of Full Tilt's revenues every – he gets a check every month that would blow away – yeah, the numbers would just be ridiculous.
Right, so, and there's more than a few guys in that category, correct?
Correct. There's a handful of the people who were there at the beginning. Howard Lederer essentially is the almost the one of the founding father of Full
Tilt. That guy Eric somebody.
Eric Seidel.
Yeah.
Yeah, another guy who's won a lot of World Series bracelets.
Yeah.
There's several of them who are at the ground floor who would have, like, literally, if you just have a half a percent stake in the company, half of 1%, you're getting a big check every week, and some of these have 2 or 3% stake. And that alone, you know, it makes you a multimillionaire every year. So Phil has a lot of money to play with, and he obviously plays at the highest. You know, he needs the adrenaline rush. He loves to gamble as much as you can possibly gamble on something.
Well, nowadays, with the World Series of Poker, how it's evolved, the most interesting subplot has been that it's really hard for the top guys to actually last because everybody's gunning at them, and they don't even care if they're going to get knocked out. A lot of these guys, they don't know if, you know, why is this guy going all in an hour into my tournament? Do I match him? And it just seems like people are obsessed with just, say, being, yeah, I knocked out Phil Ivey in 2008. Which isn't really technically poker. In your opinion, what is the poker tournament that really tells us who the best player is each year?
Yeah, that's hard to say, Bill. In my opinion, the best players are found who are playing at cash poker games, what we grew up playing around the kitchen table or playing social home games. Cash poker is much more skill involved than tournament poker. There's too much luck or too much variance in any one tournament. So it's hard, anybody can make it, you or I can make it through a tournament of 500 people and win just by sheer luck.
Yeah.
So I have much more respect for the people who win at the cash games. And you also mentioned the other factor now that makes it really tough in tournaments is that people come there with just the sole thing they want to get involved in a pot against Phil Hellmuth or Phil Ivey or Daniel Negreanu. And so these guys have a target on them, and it makes it very hard for them. It makes it harder for them to play. Guy's just trying to take the big player out, or he's on the television feature table, so he wants to get involved in the pot with the player. It's just too many minefields, too many mines to avoid if you're a really good player. So I can't even tell you that one tournament determines the best player. The best players are generally determined on who's winning the most money when they're playing away from tournaments.
Hey, do you like this whole break where the tournament basically goes on hiatus for, what is it, 2 months, 3 months, and then we play the final table in November? Doesn't this give guys a chance? Like, wouldn't this give Phil Ivey a chance to actually study Darvin Moon and see if there's any tells that he can pick up?
That's exactly what they do. I was not a fan of the break. I knew the break would create more interest, so that it has, even more so than I could have guessed. So it makes sense from a marketing standpoint. The ratings went way up. Viewership went way up last year. On that delayed final table for the first time. And yeah, but everyone has the same advantage that you're talking about.
Right.
They can hire coaches, and some do. They can study the videotape. They can talk to friends of the players. It changes the competitive nature of how it breaks down, but everyone is given the same set of circumstances. It is almost, though, equivalent to, stopping, an NFL game, no matter what the score is, with, 2 minutes and 15 seconds left, and say, we'll pick it up again in 3 weeks.
That'd be a problem.
It seems like it would be a problem.
Yeah.
Poker's a little different, so it does work for poker, and it's, like I said, it was pretty successful last year. I suspect the viewership will be up even again this year.
See, I think it's a gigantic advantage for Phil Ivey. Because as we discussed before, the guy is the greatest poker face of all time. He has no tells at all. And obviously he's going to be able to study these tapes and pick like little tiny things about each guy. And I don't know. I think this could be his time. I really do.
No, you're right. For the better player, it is an advantage. And since he's the best at picking up, not even just picking up tells on the players, but then analyzing how players played certain hands. And that's even more important than the tells, Bill. It just in having a memory bank where in your head you determine what's the likelihood that a player is holding what cards based on what they're betting, based on other hands you've seen them play in the past. And a guy like Ivy is just a master of that, as is Daniel Negreanu, in sort of breaking down the player in terms of their tendencies. Tells sometimes are overrated. You can pick up some stuff, but it's more on tendencies of how somebody plays in a certain situation.
How long do you see the final table lasting?
It's you never know. They'll play down to heads up, and then they'll take a break again. And last year it took 12 or 14 hours. It's a fast final table, so it only takes 5 or 6 hours. It often takes 10 hours or more. So, anywhere from 4 or 5 hours to 12 or 14 hours.
And what kind of crowd are we looking at?
It's weird. It's not a spectator sport. They put it in the Penn and Teller Theater, which filled up last year with 1,500 people who can't see a thing. I mean, you're sitting in just imagine sitting in any performance arts theater. There's a table down in the middle. You can't see the whole cards. There's a big TV screen that shows you the community cards that come up, but you have absolutely no idea what's going on. And usually the only people there are friends and family. And now everybody brings like 100 or 200 people, each of the 9 players. So it's packed. But it's really a hard thing to watch live because most poker hands, and particularly in a tournament, somebody raises the blinds, everybody else folds, move on to the next hand. I mean, that goes on for hours on end, it seems. And people don't seem to realize that when they're just watching the 1 or 2 hour telecast.
Yeah, I was going to say, unedited poker is boring to be involved if you're playing.
It is.
You sit there for 45 minutes, just zoned out of your mind, waiting for a good card.
I think it was Tom McAvoy, one of the poker players, that said something about poker is hours of endless boredom, followed by moments of sheer terror when you have to put all your chips in. But it is hours of endless boredom live. It's hard to keep up, your radar when you're playing there. It actually mentally drains you sitting at that table for that long, and you got to be careful in No Limit because, any mistake you make could take you out of the tournament.
So who's your pick? Make a pick.
I actually don't make picks. I have favorites, and I mentioned them earlier. If Phil Ivey or Darvin Moon wins the thing, I'll be one of the 5 happiest men west of the Mississippi for a 24-hour period.
What do you mean you don't make picks?
In poker, I don't make picks. I make picks,
Is this like a Chris Collinsworth on Inside the NFL type thing, where you won't pick the game you're broadcasting?
Bill, when I used to do an NFL picks column, I didn't make picks. I flipped a coin on every game. People thought I was kidding. I flipped a coin on every game to prove the point that, this year you're having a really good year. You know, you had a bad week last week, I believe.
Yes.
I think you were like 4-8 or 4-9 last week.
You know what it was? It was the book tour.
I don't think it was a book tour. You jinxed yourself by chirping about it.
But I was trying to reverse jinx my jinx.
That never works. See how hard it is? You can't reverse jinx a jinx.
I did too many jinxes.
So anyway, I didn't pick games when I picked games. I just flipped a coin to say, hey, I'm flipping a coin. I'm going to do better than if I was actually picking them. Picking all the games, how hard it is to hit like even 55% in a year? You're a master if you're picking all the NFL games.
So we're running this on Tuesday.
We're running this Tuesday. Tuesday
night. We come back on Wednesday to do a little after the show recap.
Now, I'll give you a pick then if you need it and you're available. Yes, I am around on Wednesday.
We'll give you like four. Give us like 4 anecdotes from the Rio. I'm excited. I got to be honest. Like everyone else who's over competitive. I had my little poker run and I did the whole online thing and I was watching it and I kind of fell out of it mostly because I didn't really like a lot of the players. Like, to me, somebody like Helmuth, I can't stand him, and I don't think he has any redeeming qualities, and I just don't like him. I just think he's a bully, and he's not a funny guy, and I think a lot of the people who try to be funny at these tables, they're not funny at all. They're poker funny.
Right.
It's like when somebody's athlete funny, and they're not actually funny. I just had it. Ivy has sucked me back in.
Well, I'm glad he sucked you back in. He's the right guy to suck you back in.
Well, it's like golf. I was out on golf, and then Tiger showed up, and now I watch every major. But I just think he's really fascinating, so I'm going to be watching the whole thing. Good luck. We'll talk to you on Wednesday. Thanks for coming up.
All right. Have a good one, Bill.
All right. Now the phone call I've been dreading. Our old friend Jacko, Yankee fan, winner of a 27 title. we promised win or lose we would make this call on Friday. We're going to make the call. I do have a little ace up my sleeve that I don't think he's expecting. Might make him mad, but screw it. He's been gloating a lot. So here we go. Let's call him at work on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Jacko.
Bill, Jacko, partners in crime.
Complex Litigation, this is John.
Oh, congratulations, John.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you very much. Can you feel it? Can you taste it?
Are you going to be obnoxious?
The sun is shining brighter. The air smells better. Food and drink taste better. All is right with the world, Willie. All is right with the world.
In your opinion.
Things have returned to normality. After 9 years of mistakes and errors and miscues, all is right with the world again.
Well, congratulations for buying the title.
Oh, here we go. Yeah, that's what they did. Yep.
Well, they did. They kind of did.
Yeah, absolutely right. They spent the same amount, they spent a similar amount of money as they spent for the past 8 years. And this year they won it because the team came together, guys performed. Buying the World Series, such a misnomer.
It's great for baseball. It's great for baseball that the team that spends the most money wins every year.
Except that they don't win every year.
Yeah, they actually...
They haven't won in 9 years.
I don't really believe in this case because my own Red Sox have spent nearly as much money, just they spent it on the wrong guys.
Look at the Mets.
Yeah.
All these teams spend a lot of money.
Yeah.
Don't hate the player, Bill. Hate the game, as they say in the rap community. I mean, you can't kill the Yankees for playing by the rules as they currently exist.
You know what the key to the whole thing was, in my opinion?
What's that?
Andy Pettit.
Yeah.
The fact that he is still really good at this advanced stage of his life almost belies, you know, career arcs of most baseball pitchers, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal when you think about like what they are now calling the core four. Of the four guys who won their fifth ring the other night, I mean, they all came through. I mean, the ageless...
Who's calling them the core four?
Well, New York media, I suppose. People. Yankee fans.
you and your dad? I didn't think. So Andy's 37 years old.
Yes, he is.
He gave you 194 innings.
Yeah.
And then he gave you another 30 innings.
He pitched all three clinching games in the three rounds of the playoffs.
Since 2005, last 5 years, he has thrown over 1,000 regular season innings and has also obviously pitched in the postseason. Like, pretty crazy, because I don't know if Burnett would have been up to the challenge. If
game six, if they had pitched like Chad Gaudin in game five?
I don't know. You know, I mean, obviously you won because of the 1, 2, 3, 4 guys in Rivera, but the fact that Andy Pettit is continuing to be solid, I think, is kind of amazing.
Yeah, he was huge. I don't know that he was really the key to things. I mean, I suppose to a degree he was.
But you knew you were going to win Game 6. If Burnett's pitching Game 6 and not Pettit, the door's open for Philly a little bit, but in that situation you knew Pedro's getting shelled and... I don't know.
I mean, the confidence that I had in Game 6 was not so much on Andy Pettit. It was more that I knew Pedro wasn't going to show up again.
And you knew Pettit wasn't getting shelled.
Well, I didn't, though. I really didn't know that, no.
I mean, even on Halloween when he gave up, what did it, was it 2-0 or 3-0?
3-0,
I still felt
yeah.
like he was going to still be there in the sixth inning.
I mean, he did settle down in that game, but he wasn't really ever, like, lights out at any point. And there's been a lot of times he's blown up, too, and especially on short rest. A 37-year-old guy on 3 days rest made me very nervous.
Right.
And I was really worried about that. I mean, I wish I had more confidence in him, but I really didn't. He really had me worried. But I had less confidence in Pedro. That was what balanced it out. I figured the game was going to be like 9-8 or 8-6, and the Yankees offense would win it, but I didn't have a huge amount of faith in Pettit.
Where did this team rank among your favorite Yankee teams?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, when the 96 team won it, that was really, like, huge for me. That team has a special place in my heart just because you know, they hadn't won it since I was 8 years old. So it's like, I'm sure my parents probably made me go to bed early in 1978. So to actually see the team win it at an age that I was cognizant of what was going on, that really meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
In 96. And it was, you know, the first one in 18 years and all that. So that
was the most special one for the Yanks fans. I agree.
And the one that, and the way they won it, having lost the first two games at home, and then sweeping through Atlanta and the famous Leyritz home run off Wohlers. I mean, that was just amazing because you were like, the team was young, and you're like, well, they just weren't ready this year when they lost the first two games to the Braves. And then to come back and win it was really amazing. The 98 team was special because it won 125 games counting the playoffs. But this one's up there. This one's probably, you know, this one might be ahead of the 98 team just because it's been a long 9 years and, you know, it's been a long wait. So I like this team. I like the, you know, I've talked about this before. I like the pies in the face and the Nick Swisher and A.J. Burnett and the loose clubhouse and going to play pool in the spring training and going to see the movies together and all. They seem like they have a lot of camaraderie, you know?
Did Nick Swisher, who you belittled when they acquired him.
I did. I was
ready
with you
when that happened.
You had literally talked me off a balcony.
Yeah, yeah. You saw the news, and then you headed out towards the balcony in our hotel room, and I got worried. I didn't know what was going to happen.
Yes. Well, because at the time, I thought that meant he was going to be their everyday first baseman, and that foreclosed any opportunity to go after Mark Teixeira.
I'm looking at Pettit's postseason. He has had 15 straight postseason starts dating back to 03 that he's at least pitched five innings. And he's gone, this year he went 6.1, 6.1, 6.1, 6.0, 5.2. Pretty good.
Yeah, no, he's...
And considering that you never had to sacrifice your crappy four starter, which is basically, you know, that's how a lot of teams get into trouble. I know, that's what killed the Red Sox in 86 when we had to give Al Nipper his sacrificial loss.
Yeah.
You never had to do that because these guys could all go 3 days. But I think the fact that you had... You had it locked up in September, and these guys were rested. Maybe that helped, too.
It did. And they talked about a thing like the Yankees had, like, every Thursday in September off. So because of that off day, they could rest their core guys. And because they had built up a little bit of a lead, yeah, they could rest guys. It definitely was a factor. I mean, I was getting nervous of going to the well of CC on 3 days. But he didn't pitch the 250 innings that he had in the past for Cleveland and for Milwaukee. So it made a huge difference. He had a lot of arm left.
Well, he can store 50 pounds of fat. He's like a bear.
You sound so bitter. I can't tell if it's because the Yankees won or the book tour is just grinding you down to a shell of yourself.
You know,
I'm happy about it, though.
I'm a little bitter that Philly didn't put up a better fight.
Really? I don't know. Philly's a good team, though. I mean, they got a pretty good lineup. I wish I could hate somebody on the team except for Pedro, and I really just couldn't. I couldn't generate any hate for anyone on the Phillies. I even like Charlie Manuel. I like him a lot.
I kind of had the same problem with the Yankees. My most of my hatred was generated toward their fans.
That's understandable.
And the people who were emailing me as the World Series became more and more of a foregone conclusion.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's
my cousin and my uncle. And
that's ridiculous. I think I forgot if you had it in a chat or mailbag or on Twitter or something, but you said when the Yankees were winning the ALCS, and you said, "Oh, Yankee fans just found my email address again. Apparently, they had lost it for 5 years or something."
Right.
I mean, if you weren't talking smack the whole way through, it's just that's why people hate Yankee fans is because there's such a front-running aspect to them.
Totally.
If you haven't been here and suffered the slings and arrows for years or talked any smack for 5 years now you can't come out of the woodwork and be like, yeah, we're the greatest. You stink, you know? Like, you just can't.
Yeah, you've definitely been a devoted fan through and through. Joe Mead, let's play the 57-second Rivera cut. Hold on, Johnny.
All right.
And then you have Mariano Rivera as the closer, whose name was just recently changed to Property of the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah, the most overrated player in the history of Major League Baseball. I say that,
You're standing by that. Wow.
I'm not kidding. He's the most overrated player in the history of Major League Baseball. The closer position is overrated to begin with.
Yeah.
But he is so grossly overrated and living on the past from what he did back in 96 when they could end games in the sixth inning because he could pitch the seventh and the eighth and Wetland pitched the ninth. This is a guy that blew the 2001 World Series and has blew the 2004 series to the Red Sox and is so owned by the Red Sox, it's not even funny. In his last 70 appearances, he's blown 12 games to their most hated, heated rival, games that he absolutely has to close down, has to. I don't care that he's great against the Kansas City Royals and his lights out against them. That's great. That's fantastic, Mariano. Can you do one time, one thing against the Red Sox?
Wow.
Bill, I'm not here to talk about the past. That was in the heat of the moment of just having gotten swept by the Red Sox, which absolutely destroys me like nothing else does. So, but that literally, in retrospect, was the single stupidest thing I've ever said in my life.
Well, I don't think we're done yet, Jack.
Luckily
Joe,
for me, it was not on tape.
Can you play the Jeter supermodel one?
Oh, God. Jeter is the captain. I mean, I like Derek Jeter, who's always been a great Yankee, but he shouldn't be the captain because his biggest concern is what supermodel he's going to bang after the game instead of doing anything in the locker room to fire anybody up or have anybody play like a Major League Baseball player.
Oh, Johnny. Oh, Johnny.
That's a bad job by me. There's no two ways about it. Those were, you shouldn't say things in the heat of anger.
Well,
I shouldn't
you know,
have
like,
done that podcast that day, but what can I tell you? I did.
You mean
there they are.
Things like how you'd trade anyone in the Yankees for Euclid or Pedroia, Joe?
There's not a single player on the Yankees that I would not trade for Euclid and or Pedroia. They are
really?
So far and away better than anyone on the Yankees. I would trade anyone on the Yankees for it to have one-eighth of the heart of Euclid. Strong statements there by me in April. Wow.
Hold on, we're not done yet, Johnny.
No,
how about the next one?
Please,
blow up the team.
Please, can we be done?
No, we're almost
You know
done.
What? The Yankees need to be blown up. They need to blow up the whole thing. They need to start from scratch. They need to just, bring up some clowns from the minors. For a couple years, they're going to be awful. And maybe something happened in 2004 where the world turned upside down. I hope to God it's not the rest of my life before they win a World Series again, but it may well be at the pace the two teams are going, the two directions they're going in.
Yeah.
It may well be the rest of my life. It may be 86 years again, and I don't have 86 more years in me. So it may be the rest of my life before the Yankees ever win again. That's a distinct possibility.
Wow, Johnny.
Wow. I hope that doesn't mean my life is going to end now.
Well, the good news is that you stuck by Brian Cashman. Can we play that one?
Oh, God. DeShera stinks. He's grossly overrated. He's lost there. Oh, my God. If Cashman has a job by the end of this week, I'm done. Forget about it. I'm done. Wow.
Hold on. We just have one more.
Oh, good.
About how pathetic the Yankees are and how you hate every player in the team.
They are so pathetic. I can't even talk about it rationally, how much I hate them. I hate everyone on this team. I have a faint flicker of fondness in my heart for Derek Jeter. Even that is waning. As I hate the team. I hate the ownership. I hate the general manager. I hate the coaches, and I hate the manager. I hate everything about them. I hate their mausoleum of a new stadium, which is a complete train wreck. I hate them. The Red Sox are so far and away beyond and better than them that it makes me sick to my stomach.
Oh, Johnny. Well, you're not here to talk about the past. Are you there?
I'm still here.
You're a passionate guy.
Yep.
You feel better now?
Huh?
You feel better about the team now?
I do feel better about the team now. Yes, I do.
Would you like to apologize to the Yankee fans?
No, those were my statements in April, and I was angry at the time. But, in retrospect, it was a little strong, clearly. I feel better about them now.
Which one do you feel the worst about out of all those?
The Rivera one.
Yeah. You know what? Even me, who hates the Yankees passionately, mm-hmm. that even hurt me.
Really?
That even rattled me.
It was anger. I don't like losing to the Red Sox. I'm tired of losing to the Red Sox.
Well, order has been restored, as you've said. Mm. Now I'm the one venting about the Red Sox. Thank God we didn't do a podcast after the 15-inning game.
True. That would have been ugly. Yeah.
All hell would have broken loose.
At least you have Jeremy Hermita. That's the final piece of the puzzle.
I mean, really? Another pitch count guy who hits 250? We needed to add another guy like that to
another reclamation project because all of your reclamation projects last year worked out so well.
I think Bill James came up with some weird theory in his computer about if we just added every single guy in the lineup, took seven pitches, something crazy offensively could potentially happen. And now that's the goal.
Mm.
Just maybe like 63 pitches for every two and a third innings or something. And he's crunched those numbers and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, that must be the deal because it doesn't, I don't think he's the answer, Jeremy Hermita.
Can I ask you about the Yankees parade?
By all means.
Did you watch it?
No, I didn't. I was at work. I haven't seen any of it.
What did they do during the Yankee parade?
What do they do?
Yeah, what do they do?
I mean, in the past, they go down the Canyon of Heroes on floats, and crowd waves, and the players wave back, and then they go to City Hall, and the mayor makes some awkward speech pretending to be a fan and gives them all the keys to the city. And then usually somebody will get up and make some awkward joke about having the key to the city, and that's about it.
Is Kate Hudson going to be involved?
I don't know. It's a good question. A lot of times I think, like, players' wives are up on the floats with them. I know she's not a player wife, but
Do you think she's like, what's that girl's name, Mika Kelly? I don't want to be on the same float as Mika Kelly. Do you hear me?
Yeah. Maybe they got in different cars or floats. I'm not sure. They don't have, like, a duck boat thing like they have in Boston, so there's no, like, unique New York form of transportation. They just, I think it was just, like, a parade float last in the 90s.
What about Steinbrenner? Does he go to this? Like, do they just prop him up and he tell him to wave?
No, I don't think so. If they didn't have him there for the final game, I don't think they're going to have him anywhere for the parade.
Oh, he wasn't there?
No.
Who accepted the trophy?
Hal Steinbrenner.
Oh, no.
And Hank Steinbrenner.
I didn't know that.
Hank Steinbrenner was off in the background. And Hal Steinbrenner was, like, front and center. And then his sister was also sort of front and center. But Hal, and it's funny, everybody in the, like, all the Steinbrenners were wearing Yankees garb, Yankees jackets, and then they put on the world champion hats. But Hal was just, like, in a black suit off in the back. I think he was, like, cupping a cigarette so you couldn't see him smoking a cigarette on air. It was Hal Steinbrenner that got the trophy. And then all the players did this thing about, like, how they, you know, Girardi said he had talked to George Steinbrenner, and they had this big thing on the scoreboard where it said, like, we did it for George, and they were like, we're going to win one for George. That didn't really ring true to me, since George Steinbrenner is, like, one of the most dislikable human beings on the planet. And, like, so, I mean, sorry, I like what he's, you know, done for the Yankees, obviously, but to be,
yeah,
like, warm and fuzzy, like, let's win this for George, like, win one for the Gipper, didn't quite ring true to me in any sort of a sense. In the 70s, when he was, like, you know, calling players out in the media and, you know, coming down to the locker room and berating them and firing Billy Martin on a whim and calling down to the dugout and everything else. Not
and
really
framing Dave Winfield.
What's that?
And framing Dave Winfield.
Right, hiring private eyes to, like, chase Dave Winfield around and try and find some dirt on him. Yeah, not really, like, warm and fuzzy. Like, let's do it for him, yeah.
Did Hal Steinbrenner speak, or he just...
Oh, yeah, when he got the trophy, he was like, you know, usual platitudes, New York, you're the best fans in the world, and... Yada,
it wasn't
yada.
Like a Jerry Buss's son type speech?
No, it was not. No, thank goodness, no. Hal's pretty with it. I think that's why he sort of took over, because he doesn't have the bluster of Hank. He's much more calculating and quiet, so he was like, you know, he was dignified.
Well, what do we make of Brian Cashman now?
Well, the interesting thing is, when they won the ALCS and when they won the World Series, I didn't see a single picture of Brian Cashman. He wasn't there to get the trophy. There was no interviews with him. He wasn't up on the podium either time. Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, was there both times in a Yankee jacket, even though he's a Mets fan.
Yeah.
And much in evidence, like, just praying to be interviewed by somebody. But thankfully, he never was. But Brian Cashman was nowhere to be seen. I was wondering, like, if somebody in his family sick, or is he sick? Like, why? Does he have the swine flu? Like, why isn't he here? I read the New York papers, and they had interviews with him in the locker room, but he was not seen at all. Like, I stayed up till after 1 watching the post game on the YES Network and on ESPN, and he was nowhere to be seen.
They didn't even show him, like, in the luxury suite doing a fist bump?
Never. I didn't see a sign of him at all. That's why I was like, I really thought, like, is his father ill or something? He's not at the game? It was weird. I don't understand what that was all about.
Well, but do we think he did a good job, or he just finally spent money correctly for the first time in 8 years?
Well, allegedly he really wanted Teixeira and knew he was a perfect fit for the Yankees, and he had to go and, like, twist Hal Steinbrenner's arm to go and sign him. So,
yeah.
I mean, if he did that, it was smart. I mean, you know, he went out and got Sabathia and Burnett. I mean, I'm not a huge Burnett fan. They love Burnett a lot more than I do. He was okay this year, and he was okay in the postseason. I don't think he was lights out by any stretch over the long course of things, and he was terrible in game 5. But Sabathia, I mean, but, you know, anybody would have known to go sign Sabathia when you don't have a frontline starter, you don't have an ace, and he's sitting out there. That doesn't take a rocket scientist to do it. I mean, I don't know if he gets credit for finding guys like Alfredo Aceves down in the Mexican League, and he was huge for him this year, or moving Phil Hughes to the bullpen. I mean, they had to move Hughes to the bullpen because they were hot to start Wong again when he got back, and then they couldn't send Phil. They didn't want to send Phil Hughes back down, so they kind of stumbled into that one. I don't know if you get credit for that or not. So, I mean, he, you know, he won the World Series. That's what I guess it all comes down to. You're judged by results, and he won the ultimate result. So I guess you have to say he did a good job.
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, the Damon contract was probably the best contract he gave out. Everybody thought he overpaid for him. That guy, I don't know.
I mean, the $4 million difference, they went $4 million higher than the Red Sox, and he's been a huge player for them offensively. I really hope they re-sign him. His swing is tailor-made to Yankee Stadium, especially the new Yankee Stadium with his uppercut swing to right field. It's perfect.
Good clubhouse guy.
Good clubhouse guy. Everybody seems to love him. I mean, you know, he can't throw to save his life, but and he's an adventure in the outfield. I mean, he's always looks like he's running the wrong way after the ball, but
yeah.
I like Johnny Damon. He's a good player. He's huge for them offensively. So, yeah, I hope they re-sign him. That was a good signing.
I didn't realize Teixeira's postseason stats were that bad. Man,
oh, yeah, he was brutal.
Holy mackerel. 167 in the ALDS, 222 in the ALCS, and then 3 for 27 in the World Series, or 3 for 22.
He was terrible. And then, you know,
macro.
He was getting a little flack in the New York papers because they were saying how he had a lot of excuses, or he'd have, like, a lot of yeah buts and talk about, like, his defense. And his defense was great, but
yeah.
Instead of just saying, like, oh, yeah, I've been, you know, I really got to start hitting the ball and, you know, I got to focus or whatever, some platitudes about, like, I've got to be better and produce for this team, he was, like, very, like, kind of prickly and defensive about it, the fact that he didn't do anything offensively. He was getting a little flack. But then
he had the Nathan Sturm cigarette going?
Pretty much, yeah, he did. And then, but winning the World Series kind of cures everything, so all is forgiven. And A-Rod's emergence was huge. I mean, guy had a phenomenal postseason, you know. I mean, it just, and all, yeah, I think all this thing about, like, well, he's who's a true Yankee and who's not a true Yankee and all that, I think that's a lot of hooey anyway, but I mean, you can't deny he's a true Yankee now. He's got a ring. He produced in the postseason. That's all you can ask for.
In your heart, do you think those were real tears?
Of his? Oh, yeah. I think he looked legit. I think he, I don't think, I mean, he, I realize that he's very media savvy and very programmed, but I don't think you would fake it and, like, look around for a camera at that moment when you finally get the 15-year monkey off your back of winning a championship. I just don't think you're going to fake that.
But if you did fake it, would you...
You would fake it when he was, like, with Jeter or something. He wouldn't do it when he's hugging Eric Hinsky.
You wouldn't grab the top of your nose and kind of do that whole thing?
I don't know. Maybe he took an acting class. Maybe Kate Hudson was, like, working with him with her acting coach. I don't know.
Do you think him and Kobe went to the same crying acting coach?
But A-Rod, I mean, A-Rod really did have a lot of pressure of, like, it has to be bothersome to get killed all the time in the papers.
Yeah.
You know, for years and years, and you're no good, and you're a bum, and everything else. So to finally, like, get that off your back, it's got to feel good. I think those were legit. Guy's getting a ring, you know?
He seemed liberated, I got to say, this whole season. It was like the steroid thing. I don't know. It just seemed different.
Everybody and their brother, like, that has to do, like, the, you know, Dr. Joyce Brothers psychoanalysis of A-Rod now. That's like the,
yeah.
Every sports writer has to do that, you know, do that. So, I don't know. I never took psychology in college, so.
You don't feel like he was different? He seemed different.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if he was different or not. I mean, I still saw press conferences where he gave these sort of, like, rote answers of that you just knew was, like, fed to him by Boris or Boris's PR team.
Mm.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, his production was better. That's what it comes down to for me. If a guy gets big hits at big times, I don't really care what goes on in his personal life or what kind of angst he has or whether he has pictures of him as a centaur or not. I just really don't care as long as the guy gets big hits for me. You know, you're just rooting for laundry. So,
he had 6 homers, 18 RBI.
Yeah.
Hit like almost 400.
I mean, he hit that 2-run homer off Hamels in that game that where they were like, it was a crucial game, game 3,
yeah.
When they were down 3-0, and he hit that 2-run homer, and it sparked them and you know, got them going. It was phenomenal job by him. He had a lot of big hits in the postseason. And,
yeah,
you know, part of it is, I think, is they have the lineup now with Teixeira that he doesn't have to be the guy, so he's not, like, gripping the bat into sawdust, and he can just sort of, you know, relax and put up numbers and you know, go from there.
You know what's interesting is, and this happened with John Elway and this happened with Peyton Manning, is that you think of, like, the amount of words that were said and written about somebody as a postseason guy and he can't come through in the clutch and all that crap. And then it happens and it just kind of vanishes.
Yeah, exactly. Like Peyton Manning, no one ever talks about that with
never.
Peyton Manning.
It's never mentioned again. John Elway, maybe
right.
15 years of him, well, he can't win the big one. And then he wins it and it's just never, it must be such a relief for these guys.
And, you know, I mean, John Elway couldn't win it until he got Terrell Davis and they had a running game. And A-Rod, I guess, couldn't win it until he had another big bat in the lineup. Giambi never was the guy. And they got Teixeira and he provided enough protection or took enough pressure off of him that he was able to do it. So I don't know who Peyton Manning got. A defense, I guess, to win it that year. But
were you more excited that the Yankees won the World Series or that Isaac Guillen was one of the commentators for
it? You know, normally TV shows are on like a 7-second delay, but with Ozzy, I think they were on like a 27-second delay. Because I was like, this is, I mean, if he can get through this without dropping an MF-er, it's going to be like miraculous. I think Chris Rose had like an electric cattle prod just in case he said something, you know, they could zap Ozzy. He was an adventure. You just didn't know what he was going to do or say. It was exciting.
I really don't think closed captioning would have been a terrible idea.
Well, that's true.
I mean, it's not, you know, it just, for somebody like my dad, he was just straining and squinting at the TV the whole time.
The thing is, like, Mark Gray seemed like he was an okay guy, but I don't know that he really brings a lot to TV.
Yeah.
And Eric Karros is kind of like a mannequin.
Yeah.
So at least Ozzy was like an injection of personality. I mean, you couldn't always make out every word, but at least you got the sense of what he was talking about. So I
was
hoping he was going to swear.
So what happens now, Johnny?
I don't know. Do we still get to do these podcasts? Or
I'm not
worried anymore.
I mean, you'll never be worried? What happens next year?
No, I'll be worried. I'm sure I'll be worried again. But you know, I feel good now. I mean, these things might have to turn around. It might have to be you that's worried. Your team's in transition, not getting any younger. And, you know, people are straining for them to do a big move this offseason, and they come right out of the gate with the Jeremy Hermida. And
yeah.
Boy Wonder sort of makes, you know, a lot of illusions, more than illusions, outright says, like, you know, don't expect us to do something big. And, you know, we still got some contracts that have to come off the books. And we're waiting for these young kids that aren't quite ready yet to come up, trying to, like, temper down the fans and their level of excitement. You know, Boston has a sense of entitlement now after winning it 2 years, after winning it twice.
Not anymore.
And I don't know, that they're a little itchy. They're getting a little anxious again.
I'm anxious.
Understandably.
We have a lot of big-ass dead contracts coming next year. Like the, I think Lowell and Ortiz get a combined 25, and then JD gets another 13 or 15 or
14
something,
yeah.
Oh, my Lord.
The funny thing is that what always humors me, and I always read, like, the Boston stuff online just because, you know, I like to follow our biggest rival. And
that's not why you read it. You like to get upset, and you like to relish in their misery.
Exactly. I like to wallow in their misery. But, I mean, the thing that's interested me now about the Red Sox in the second half of the season and now that they've been eliminated in the postseason is Theo can just, like, throw out these crumbs to people, like he talks about how they, you know, and people report, and who knows if it's true or not, but there's these reports that they threw the kitchen sink at Seattle for King Felix, or they threw the kitchen sink at San Diego for Adrian Gonzalez. Now, they didn't get either one of those players,
yeah.
But now if you read, like, all the Red Sox things, everybody just thinks, oh, we're just going to throw the kitchen sink at them again, and we're just going to get either one or both of those guys.
Mm.
I mean, who knows if any of that was even true? It's like, it would be like, you know, if the Yankees are like, we called about Pujols. You know, they called the Cardinals, we're like, how's Pujols? And the Cardinals were like, he's great, you're never getting him. And then Cashman's like, well, we put some calls in about Pujols. And then the fans went all crazy. I mean, you didn't.
Johnny, wait a second. Are you saying the Red Sox are manipulating their media cronies? Come on.
That's my guess.
They've never done that.
And all it takes, apparently, is some leaks to go out and say, like, well, we made some calls, and the fans get all excited. And it doesn't even take doing a big move. It just requires inferring that there was almost a big move, and that's, like, good enough for the fans to, like, salivate all offseason and go crazy and have all this speculation about how, you know, they're going to go get, like, every other team's best player with their amazing farm prospects that are not quite as amazing as they once were.
Oh, no, the word is out now on their farm prospects. They, you know, the latest slew of evaluations, it's not nearly as juicy as they have tried to claim in the past.
I mean, for 3 years they've been talking about this guy Lars Anderson, who's going to be like the first baseman of the future, and the guy's hit like 220 in Double-A.
Yeah, they're in some trouble, and they also lost Jed Hoyer. He signed with San Diego. I'm worried. I actually think that this 2010 Red Sox season has the potential to be what the 2008 Yankee season was, where they're saddled by these big deals, and they know the winter is coming, and they'll be able to kind of reinvent the roster and spend some money.
Yeah.
But they won't be able to do it until the season's over, basically.
Right.
So they'll win in that 90 to 96 range, but you can't win in baseball like that when you're giving away that much money.
Right, and you have that many holes in your lineup of these old guys. Yeah. I mean, Lowell's got a big heart, but he's not getting any younger. And Big Poppy, I mean, he's a wreck. He was a wreck this year. I mean, he ended up putting up halfway decent numbers from June on, but he's not getting any younger next year.
Yeah, and they're floating it out like they're going to go after Holiday, but I just don't think it makes a lot of sense when you look at how much salary they're shelling out and how much they've been willing to spend in the past. I don't see it.
I mean,
Johnny, I think we have to, maybe next year for the podcast, I think we have to do, I think you have to call me.
Billy, are you worried yet? Yeah.
I think we do. I just don't see, you know, you're going to turn 40 next year, you're not going to be worried anymore.
This is not really a huge free agent year, so unless you pull some trades and, you know, are able to steal some people from other teams, I mean, I don't know, Matt Holiday doesn't get me excited at all.
Me neither.
I mean, it was shown he couldn't do anything in the American League, and then he went over to the National League, and yeah, he put up big numbers for the Cardinals, but he was terrible in Oakland.
Well, unfortunately, you know, they kind of knew last year that Tex was going to be the big guy, not for that winter, but for this winter, too.
Yeah.
Nobody this winter that even comes close to Tex or CeCe.
And in terms of, like, pitching, I mean, John Lackey's okay, but he doesn't put the fear of God into you if you're an opposing team, I don't think.
I don't think so either.
I don't know who, like, you know, breaks the bank on John Lackey, but...
But that's another spot where the Red Sox are kind of blocked, because, you know, Dice K, the money they committed to him...
Yeah.
And that's Lackey money, basically. You know, I know he's on board for short money, his actual salary, but when you add in the, whatever, the 52.8 signing bonus or whatever it was...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Johnny, what's left for you? The Duel? The Ruins, I mean?
The Ruins, yeah. I watched that last night. I DVR'd that on Wednesday. Did
Cajada get voted off?
No.
Maybe Cajada is your new sports dream now that the Yankees have clinched the World Series.
Well, you know, Cajada in 2 weeks has taken out Wes and Cyrus. It's
unbelievable.
Pretty impressive. I mean, Cajada looks like he's about 5'2", 130 pounds.
I love him.
So I like his accent.
All right, Johnny. You're not mad at me for playing the clips, are you?
A little bit.
A tiny bit? I can tell you're a little mad.
Yeah, I'm a little mad.
You are? Are you going to get mad at me later?
No, I'll get over it. I'm still basking in the glow of the championship.
Come on, I had to play the clips. Don't be mad at me.
It's all right.
Are you less or more mad than when I ruined the Usual Suspects for you?
No, that had some humor to it. That was funny.
You didn't think the clips were funny?
No, it was all right.
Come on.
One was funny. Five was a little over the top.
What do I have left? You won the World Series.
No, it's fine. It's all right. It's okay. I'm basking in the championship. I'm a champion. It's okay.
You're not going to talk to me for a while, are you?
No, I am.
Are you sure?
I promise.
Come on. We can't have bitterness. We've known each other for 21 years.
No, it's fine.
If the roles were reversed, would you have played the five clips?
Probably not five.
You would have played four?
Like two would have probably done it.
Three and a half?
Maybe, yeah. No, it's fine. It's all good.
And
somebody at work, I brought in some bagels yesterday, and I wore in some Yankees garb because there's a plethora of Red Sox fans here. And so when I invited people to come down and have some New York-style bagels in honor of World Series number 27, somebody said, oh, good, it's Gloatfest 2009. So it is. I'm still basking in the glow of Gloatfest.
That's why I had to play the five clips.
That's right. Bring me down a notch. Bring me back down to earth.
Well, we haven't had any bitterness yet in the podcast, so I think this was good.
A little anger, that's right. No, it's fine.
All right, well, I guess we won't talk until Christmas.
No,
mad at me?
We'll talk before then, I'm sure.
Oh, Johnny. I'm sorry I rained on your parade, Johnny.
You didn't, it's fine. It's all good. Mission 27 is completed. Mission accomplished. Now we turn the page to Mission 28.
We will call you in a couple weeks as soon as one of our teams does something dumb over the winter.
Fantastic.
And the odds are it's going to be my team.
Hopefully. Let's hope.
All right, Johnny.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Target the sound off.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
You laughed. You cried. You turned up the sound repeatedly, and now it's all over. Thus concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all this talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just breaking news.
The $5 footlong anthem rolls on with Subway Everyday Value. So many of your Subway favorites are $5 footlongs, like the Tastetacular Spicy Italian $5 footlong and the Pile Ridiculously High BLT $5 footlong, both made to your order on the freshly baked bread of your choice.